look here, you who say, today or tomorrow we are going to a certain town and we'll stay there a year. We will do business there and make a profit. How do you know what your life will be like tomorrow? Your life is like the morning fog. It's here a little while, and then it's gone. What you ought to say is, if the Lord wants us to, if it's His will, we will live and do this or that. Otherwise, you are boasting about your own plans, and all such boasting is evil. Remember, it is sin to know what you ought to do and then not do it. For the next few moments, let's imagine that you and I are alone in your family room, your living room, perhaps at your kitchen table, just you and I together. And let's say you have asked me, what would you say to me if this were the first day of the year? Not to my family, not to my friends, but what would you say to me? I think that will help make these words a lot more personal. And I want them to be that, and I think they will make them more memorable so that this will not be just another talk. I spent quite a while thinking about these first words to be shared with you on this first day of the year. This is a most unusual day when you stop to think about it. It's the first day of the rest of our life. We're all older today than we've ever been before. Furthermore, we have just completed an entire year. As of midnight last night, it ended. And at that point, this new year began. 12 unknown months, 52 unknown weeks are before us. I have no more time than you do, and you have no corner on what the future will hold any more than the one next to you or the one sitting in front or behind you. We're all, when it comes to the future, in the dark. When it comes to the past, if our memory is in good shape, we'll recall a number of things. And where we are at this moment is extremely significant. So I want to look in all three directions. I want to glance back at where we've been. I want to look at where we are. And then I want to spend the better part of our time as I close my words to you looking ahead. Even though we don't know specifically what the days and weeks hold for us. I love moments like this. We're at the crossroads of time. We haven't yet lived a day, a full day of this year. And all of it sweeps out before us. It's a good day to pause as we glance back, as we look within, as well as spend time looking ahead. I have three questions I want to ask you, one having to do with each of those moments I've just named, the past, the present, and the future. The first question: what did you learn in the past year that better prepared you for life? Second, looking within where we are right now, what changes have you made that reveal spiritual growth? By the way, you and you alone can answer these questions. No matter how well another may know you, only you know the answer to these questions. Looking within, what changes have you made that reveal spiritual growth? And then thirdly, thinking about what may lie ahead, have you decided who will be in charge of your life? So let's go back to the first, glancing back. Let's do that together. As you look over the year, your year is very different from my year. No two are the same. Even those who are married, husband and wife, those years are different. And we and our children, different. Our past is different for each of us. So as we glance back, what did you learn during those 12 months that better prepared you for life? Think about that. Wisdom usually comes from life lessons in the past. The past teaches us very helpful truth. And as we gain that truth, we gain wisdom. For that reason, we often say that wisdom does not come to the young. It takes years for it to make sense and for it to build up to such an extent that it becomes a guide for us. As you look back over the past 12 months, think about the gaining of wisdom that some of those months taught you. The poetess Sarah Teasdale has written a piece titled simply, Wisdom. I love these words. When I have ceased to break my wings against the faultiness of things and learned that compromises wait behind each hardly open gate, when I can look life in the eyes, grown calm and very coldly wise, life will have given me the truth and taken in exchange my youth. We're still looking back and we're thinking about what we learned. Don't complicate this. Maybe a simple lesson. It may be briefly stated, but it's the lesson God taught you, or lessons, plural. Psalm 90 is a rare psalm in that it is a psalm of Moses. Most of them are David's psalms, but this psalm is Moses' psalm. So it wouldn't surprise you to know Psalm 90 is dripping with perspective. It's actually a prayer. You know that psalms are prayers when they begin with calling on the Lord. So he begins by saying, O Lord, or simply, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth or the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, if I may, from the vanishing point of the past to the vanishing point of the future, you are God. The Hebrew reads, you, God. The verb is left out to emphasize the subject, God. It's all about you, O God. As I look back, as I look ahead. So we're not surprised when we drop down in that 90th Psalm to verse 12, continuing his prayer, Moses writes, teach us to number our days aright, so that we may present to you, or that we may gain a heart of wisdom. There it is again. Have you gained wisdom in the passing of those 12 months? Can you state it in a few words as in the form of a lesson learned? I will confess to you that this last year was a difficult year for me personally. Some of the things that happened, you know about, many of them you don't. I not only lost my older brother, the last living individual in our immediate family, I also lost a friend I'd cultivated for almost 50 years. Both died. The grief was deep. The loss at times still touches me. You may have gone through grief in your 12 months past. You may have been forced to your knees in some event or series of events that left you without answers. Rosanna Dana of the Saturday Night Live of yesteryear put it well. It's always something. I didn't think I'd ever live the day I'd quote Rosanna Dana from the pulpit. But today I do. It's always something. It's a saying in our home now. It's always something. Believe me, the new year will include moments that you never could have anticipated. And those words will cross your lips. It's always something. It's not that they happen that's important, it's what you learn from them that's important. What did I learn from losing the last member of my immediate family? What did I learn when my dear friend, Paul Sailhammer, passed from earth to heaven? What lesson sticks close to my heart as a result of those days of grief? How am I wiser because of that? How has the pressure of life drawn me closer to the Savior? Years ago, Cynthia and I read together the biography of Hudson Taylor, especially during the formative years of China Inland Mission. It's written, interestingly, by his son, Howard. unusual to find a biography written by one's son. This one is one of those. I shudder when I think of one of my sons writing a biography. But Howard had much to write about his godly father, Hudson, who had lost more than one wife on China soil. Following the death of a second wife and the grief of it, Howard quotes his father's words, get this, it doesn't matter how great the pressure is, what really matters is where the pressure lies. Whether it comes between you and God or whether it presses you nearer his heart. Wow. Hopefully something in the last year has pressed you nearer to the heart of God. Something you've lost, someone you've lost, some realization you become aware of, some reminder of your own temporal status, some lesson learned. That's the kind of wisdom learned in the crucible. And before we resist every journey through the crucible, remember, lessons that stay with us the longest often come in the most painful times. Just in the last few hours, I've been drawn again to a book I've loved for years. It's called The Valley of Vision. It's a series of Puritan prayers. Some of them are a bit beyond me when I attempt to go to the depths of them. I came across one just yesterday that I've loved for years, and just this morning sat down at my computer and wrote it out, at least an excerpt from it. I want you to hear these words. When thou wouldest guide me, I control myself. When thou wouldest be sovereign, I rule myself. When thou wouldest take care of me, I suffice myself. When I should depend on thy providings, I supply myself. When I should submit to thy providence, I follow my own will. When I should study, love, honor, trust thee, I serve myself. I fault and correct thy law to please myself. Instead of thee, I look to man's approbation. I am by nature an idolater, Lord. It is my chief desire to bring my heart back to thee. Convince me that I cannot be my own God or make myself happy, nor my own Christ to restore my own joy, nor my own spirit to rule me, take away my roving eye, my curious ear, my greedy appetite, my lustful heart. Show me that none of these things can heal a wounded conscience, then take me to the cross and leave me there. I hope something from yesterday or 12 months of yesterday's has drawn you closer to the cross. It helps put things in perspective. Since we are not by nature people who surrender easily, lessons learned from the past. What are they? One final word about that. They're often too personal to share with anyone. That's as it should be. Some secrets belong only to the Lord our God. They're between us and Him. And that in itself gives us wisdom. Now, looking within, looking at the present moment, question, what changes have you made that reveal spiritual growth? When you look back and draw yourself to this present moment, not just 12 months back, but when you look back over the years and you've come to this moment, what changes have occurred that prompt spiritual growth in you? With this second question, we move from the past to the present. Not back then, but here and now. That's where we find ourselves today. I'll show you an example of a once proud man, so arrogant, so mean-spirited, all done in the name of religion, that he was ready to put Christians on trial and applaud their death to get rid of that cult. His name was Saul of Tarsus. We probably don't like remembering much about that part of Paul the Apostle, but it is a part of his person. As a Pharisee, was there anyone more proud? Few were more brilliant. What a pedigree, what a impressive resume. And then that day came when the Lord broke him, blinded him, left him alone for a number of hours as he converted him. In the passing of time, God revealed to Saul of Tarsus, as he became Paul the Apostle, great revelations. Probably no more theologically astute mind aside from Christ than Paul the Apostle. Great revelations given, even from the throne of God. Could very easily have puffed him up. No one else had heard such revelations. For 14 years, he kept that to himself and finally told the full story of how the Lord humbled him rather than being puffed up about hearing and seeing these things from the Lord. He was brought to his knees. His testimony is in 2 Corinthians 12. You're familiar with it. You don't even need to turn. In the 7th verse, we read of a very mysterious part of his life, never fully revealed in detail. He was given a thorn in the flesh. The Greek word means something sharp, like a stake that is driven in the ground, like a tent peg you drive down deep. So it's something that brought pain. There have been all kinds of speculations about the thorn. What's easily missed is the purpose of the thorn. It was designed to bring him down, to keep him from boasting by his own testimony. He prayed three times specifically that it might be removed. And each time God said, no, no, no. I take it he never prayed that again. And from the thorn he learned, I quote, "My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness." Remember those words. You will not read them in the Wall Street Journal. You won't hear them in the media. Most around you won't quote them. You'll not get it in the school of higher learning. But from God, Paul learned, God's power works best in my weakness. It's a lesson learned. Part of the wisdom, part of the reason we seek Paul's words is because he learned things like that. And what he shares is filtered through that awareness. He goes on, "So now I am glad to boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ can work through me." Only you can answer this. Have you come to that place? Do you find that by the declaration of your own weaknesses and the awareness of your own weaknesses, you're at God's very best? It works against everything you read in success books today. As a result, Paul changed. As he puts it, insults, hardships, persecutions, and troubles no longer bother me. He wasn't thin-skinned. He wasn't easily offended. For he says, "When I'm weak, God shows himself strong." And he works that strength through me in unusual ways. Paul told of another major change in Philippians 4, I'll not go into except simply to state it. I've learned, get that, I've learned, it's a learned trait, that I can be content in every situation. Contentment. You're not born with contentment. You learn it. And goes on to say, I've learned to do without food, and I've learned to have an abundance. I've learned to suffer loss, and I've learned to live in opulent settings. None of it changes Paul. He was content in himself. How encouraging to read of a man as gifted and respected as Paul to speak of being contented in whatever situation he was in. He didn't expect kid glove treatment. Didn't expect always to be standing at the head of the line or sitting at the head table or under the spotlight of attention. He's very contented in the back row, on the sideline, in the shadows, watching another get the credit. Contentment leads to a life without complaint. For that reason, you do not read of complaints in Paul's writings. Amazing. Especially when you realize much of what he wrote could have been written in blood. Paul changed from pride to humility and also from expectations to contentment. Where have you changed? Or where is the change going on right now? What changes have occurred in yourself that were not there a few years ago that are helping you in your spiritual growth? All that leaves us with the third and the final issue we must face when we stand at this crossroad, especially regarding all of the unknowns of tomorrow. Have you decided who will be in charge of your life? Don't let that question just pass by. When we are honest to the bone, it's an all-important question because we love to be in charge. We love to call our own shots. We are accustomed to controlling things. Every new year, I turn my attention to those five verses in James 4 that I read for you earlier, 13 to 17. Before we dig into them, let me set the stage. It's so easy as a new year emerges to fall back into old habits we've cultivated over previous years. We do a fairly good job of running our own life. After all, we were raised to be self-reliant. That was driven home to me from far back as I can remember, probably when I began to walk, I heard words like that. Take care of yourself. Take responsibility. Speak up. Well, I learned that one, didn't I? Take charge. In other words, you don't need someone else. You can do it. You're a Swindoll. Do it. Get it done. Quit excusing irresponsibility. Driven home from my earliest days. But if we're not careful, as healthy as responsibility is, it's easy for that to lead to a self-made man or woman. There's a piece written by William Ernest Henley. You often hear it at high school graduations. It's titled Invictus. Invictus. It ends with a familiar, "It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scrolls. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Everybody applauds. Sounds so good. William Ernest Henley was one of the early humanists. It's all about me. Me, me, me. I am the master, the captain. That works till you have a stroke. That's fine till you're crippled in a collision and you may never walk again. Sounds so good, sounds so right until you lose the sight in one eye. And those physical things that occur convey a different message. Life is not about being self-made. Life is about turning over the controls to the one who has the right to be in charge. If we look at James chapter 4, we'll see right away how we think when we're on our own, growing up with that self-reliant message. Listen to this as I kind of take it apart. Verse 13. You select your own schedule, today or tomorrow. You choose your own path. We will go to such and such a city. You determine your own limits, and we'll spend a year there. You arrange your own activities, and we'll be engaged in business. Why, you even predict your own results, and we'll make a profit. Now, before we put the kibosh on all of those things, understand there's nothing wrong with planning your life. I have a day timer, and I look at it every day of the year. It helps guide me. I write in it activities that are upon me and soon will be. I write dates for appointments. I write time they begin. I write down the events where I'll speak here or where I'll be involved with someone for an event there. And there's everything right about planning, setting a schedule. There's nothing innately bad about engaging in business or planning to make a profit. What's wrong with James's point here, what he's saying is wrong, is that God and his will are conspicuous by their absence. I don't need him. Remember, I'm self-reliant. I can handle this. I take care of that. I've been around the world. I know how to do this. That is not the right mentality. Because it's all about you. So in verse 14, James points out the problem with a go-it-alone attitude. First, we're mere mortals, so we have no idea what life will be like tomorrow. So true. You have no clue what next week holds. No clue. You have no idea what this summer coming up will include for you. If I may, if you're even here. This is a sobering part of James' words. Your life is like a morning fog, like a puff of smoke. You're gone. There are some who were sitting in this worship service 1 year ago today who are gone this year. And they were as healthy as they could be 1 year ago, they thought. So you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. I mean, and it passes so quickly, life does. I mean, we go from pimples to wrinkles and a zip, just about the time your face clears up, your mind gets fuzzy. And it's so fast. You're dating here and not only married there, but before you can blink, you're standing at your son or daughter's wedding, or you're celebrating your 50th. Zip, 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 zip. If you live that long, That's why I love it the way James says it. If the Lord wants us to, we will live and do this or that. Notice the priority of the statement, we will first live. If he wants, he's in charge. He gives us breath in our lungs. He gives us every heartbeat. Brain cells function because he keeps them functioning. The ability to speak continues because he gives you the ability to articulate. Easy to forget that, especially when you perfect those things. So the good thing about thinking about tomorrow is knowing how temporary everything really is on this earth. Put bluntly, you are not the master of your fate. You are not the captain of your soul. On this unique day when we stand at the crossroads, we've looked in three directions. We've glanced back and asked, what lessons did you learn in the past 12 months that helped you live a better life? Can you name one? Just one? Surely you can. Write it down. Share it if it's one of those that you can share. See, now you know what you learned. So do it. That's the way the verses end. It is a sin to know what it ought to be done and not do it. You're no better off because you have gained some knowledge in these few minutes we've been together here in your living room or your study or at your kitchen table. You're no better off because you know these things. You're better off if you do these things. So looking within, what changes have you made that reveal spiritual growth? If your whole spiritual growth depends on Sunday morning and hearing me preach, you are a spiritual pygmy. You are not growing. You must feed yourself. You must learn how to feed yourself. That's why such emphasis is placed in our church on Bible study, on Bible groups, on support groups, helping us together learning how to be on our own spiritually. Do some thinking about that before this year gets very far along. You can't make it all on your own. You need others. And we thought ahead, asking, have you decided who's going to be in charge of your life? You know now who should be. What do you need to do to turn the controls over to him? What do you need to start doing? Let's agree to replace the narcissistic philosophy of Invictus with the wisdom of James' words and the prayer of Francis Havergal, a prayer we have sung all our lives in an old hymn that will never lose its power if we really enter into the words we're singing. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my moments and my days. Let them flow in ceaseless praise. Aren't those beautiful words? Let them flow in ceaseless praise. And then take my voice and let me sing always only for my King. Take my lips and let them be filled with messages from thee, filled with messages from thee. Take my will, make it thine, it shall be no longer mine. Take my heart, it is thine own, it shall be thy royal throne. It shall be thy royal throne. I want that for you more than I can put into words. But first of all, I need it for myself. I have no business sharing truth from one Sunday to the next if my heart isn't moved by the truth I'm sharing. If it isn't, I'm going through the motions. So much is missing when that happens. I want you to just for a moment build your own altar in your lap there. I want you to bow your heads. I want you to close your eyes. I want you to search down deep where no one else can see, no one knows. Does Christ live there in that heart of yours? Is he alive and well? Have you given him the right to rule, whatever that may include? Whatever the next 12 months may include, if he gives you all 12. Has there ever been a time in your life where you said, Lord, you and I are at a distance. I'm afraid of you. I don't understand you. I walk in another direction. I need help. I need Jesus. I so want him in my life. Please, Lord, come in and live there. Take charge. First, forgive me my sins. Wash me clean. Prepare me for heaven. Otherwise, my future is bleak and barren. So I come now to Jesus. And if you know the Lord, just offer him the controls. For some of us who are strong-willed, that's a big offer. Take control, Lord. I may look capable, I may sound capable, but I'm only as good as the next heartbeat. I'm only as strong as the next step. So remind me, Lord, that you are in charge of my life. Use me in whatever way would please you. Not me. Don't please me. Please you. And then give me a sense of satisfaction that you're having your will take place in my life. Start today, right now. Lord, we complete our time together, and then we begin to live our lives by your grace and mercy, knowing it's always something in life. Prepare us today for whatever. Take away our complaining, our habit of the glass always half empty, and give us a sense of confidence that you're doing what you want done in our lives, that we might please you, whatever that may include, whatever. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Everyone said,